State of Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable Michael J. Trickey presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. First case on the calendar this morning is State versus, is it pronounced Rethke?
Rathke, Your Honor.
Rathke. All right.
Thank you, Judge Trickey, and good morning to the court. May I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
2 minutes. Just sorry.
This is, the primary issue here is double jeopardy. I wanted to very briefly ask if the court had any questions about the issue of appellate costs, which seems to have resulted in a little bit of fireworks in the briefing.
No.
Mr. Rathke certainly hopes to prevail in this appeal, but if he does not, the assessment of appellate costs would certainly prevent him from purchasing the necessities of everyday life in prison with what little money he might have remaining in his prison account. It's pretty clear from the DOC policy that we provided that once an inmate's one-third of an ounce bar of soap is used up, you have to buy your own. So that's an important matter for him.
Before you go to double jeopardy, I had one question about the reasonable doubt instruction. The abiding belief language is in brackets. What does that mean for a trial court or lawyers practicing in front of them?
I hadn't anticipated argument on that, but it means that it's optional, I would say, in any jury instruction. I believe our concern in the briefing is the truth language. And given this court's and the Supreme Court's decisions on the fact that a criminal trial is not precisely a search for the truth. It's something slightly different and something more. That is the language we find to be improper in the instruction. Counsel did object to that, I believe. This is Mr. Rathke's double jeopardy challenge to the sexual motivation enhancement that was layered on top of his conviction for assault in the second degree. That, of course, resulted in his crime becoming a two-strike offense for purposes of the two-strikes life without parole law. I would like to start by describing the way I think this court should think of the crime that he committed and its elements, and then advocate for what I think are the questions this court should ask in assessing whether there was a double jeopardy violation. Mr. Rathke was a somewhat elderly gentleman. He was walking in the woods, and he encountered a woman, and he asked her for a hug. And she was friendly, and she allowed that to happen. And unfortunately, he held on to her for a little bit too long, just briefly, but over her protest. She located his name on a sex offender database, called the police, and as a result, he was charged with second-degree assault under Alternative E, which is a simple assault with intent to commit a felony. And he was specifically charged with intent to commit the felony of indecent liberties. Now, indecent liberties is forcible sexual contact, so he was charged with a simple assault with intent to gain sexual gratification by force. On top of that, and because this enhancement was added on top of that, he was charged with the enhancement of the fact that the crime was committed for the purpose of sexual gratification, which I would submit is virtually identical to the element of second-degree assault, and it had plainly significant consequences for punishment in this case, rendering it a strike crime. The respondent has very rightly posed the question in answer to our double jeopardy argument, isn't this legislatively authorized? And if you look at the way these statutes fit together one by one, one has to say the words are there that say you can apply sexual motivation enhancements to felonies, except for this set of felonies over here, which is quite large, and I'll get into that. But I think that this court has always, when it's assessed a double jeopardy challenge, has not started and ended necessarily with the question of whether there appears to be legislative authorization. Double jeopardy goes beyond that. And even in the Kelly case, the court asked, is there clear legislative intent to apply a firearm enhancement to this crime? In this case, I think a good example of that, the fact that the court looks both at the fact and the law in deciding whether to even ask the double jeopardy question, is your typical...
Help me understand. Are you saying that they shouldn't have charged the sexual motivation aggravator, or that they couldn't have charged assault in the second degree with the intent to commit indecent deliberate called forcible confession?
It's
that they would have had to choose, or I'm not sure what the argument is.
Our argument is that the addition of the sexual motivation enhancement resulted in two convictions that simply standing together violate double jeopardy, because the sexual motivation enhancement is the virtually identical equivalent to the intent element that's required for this particular charge of assault. Intent to have sexual contact, which is intent to gain sexual gratification. He was essentially punished.
Gets there by going to the Blockberger test. Is that how we get?
I would like the court to get to the Blockberger test, and I think that this court can get to the Blockberger test if it does what it did in the Kelly firearm enhancement case. And there, of course, the defendant argued, "Gosh, double jeopardy prevents you from giving me a firearm enhancement on this underlying crime that involves a firearm." And the court said, well, if there's clear legislative intent that an enhancement of this sort be placed on top of a crime, it seems to have a very closely related element. If there's clear legislative intent for that, what seems to be duplicative punishment, then we're not even going to get into the Blockberger test. And for the Kelly court, something that was particularly important is that the language of the firearm enhancement statute, first of all, said that it's mandatory, and then said very carefully, but we exclude five or six specifically enumerated individual crimes. Drive-by shooting, for example, a very small and narrow list of crimes. And that carefulness indicated to the court that the legislature has one by one gone through every possible crime where there might be a concern for duplicativeness and set these out as ones that it believes the enhancement should not be applied to. Now, in this case, you really cannot say that that same clear legislative intent is present. The sexual motivation enhancement applies to felonies, does not apply to sex offenses, but when you look at second degree assault, which can be assault with intent to commit a felony, you've opened up that crime of assault under subsection E to over 150 different felonies that exist in the state of Washington, and that doesn't include unranked felonies. And then you have these two crimes, sexual or indecent liberties would be one of them. The other one, of course, would be molestation, because those each involve sexual contact. Those two particular crimes, hidden within that very large list of 150 or plus felonies, does result somewhat anomalously in a crime that results in the sexual motivation enhancement being applied twice, essentially. The person is, without question, being punished for second-degree assault because they had the purpose of sexual gratification, and then again for that very same mental state.
Thank you. You have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Please, the court. I'm Seth Aaron Fine, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent of the state of Washington, and would spend most of my time on double jeopardy, but I would like to allude very briefly to the issue of cost, just because I think the counsel has misstated a significant fact. Yeah. If you look at the policy that's attached to the reply brief, a DOC inmate is not deprived of personal hygiene items because they lack money. Rather, DOC puts a debt on their account, which they will pay if and when they ever have any money to pay it. So the idea that if you impose costs that Mr. Rifke will not be able to wash himself or to shave is just not correct.
But he is serving life in prison.
He is serving life in prison.
And he's not going to make a whole lot of money.
He's not going to make a whole lot of money. He is going to make something, and a limited amount of it will be available to pay the costs if this court imposes them, and they will not be collected in any other way other than by the 20% of his earnings, which is by statute allocated for payment of legal financial obligations. And having said that, I'd like to get to what is much more important here, which is the validity of the sentence that's been imposed. And there are three things that have to be recognized about counsel's argument. The first thing is, this is not a double jeopardy case. You know, regardless of how often he says double jeopardy, Mr. Rathke was tried once, he was sentenced once. You know, double jeopardy governs cumulative sentences. There are no cumulative sentences here. There is one sentence. The question is simply, what sentence did the legislature intend? But the Blockberger test looks at when a person has committed two different crimes, did the legislature intend cumulative punishment? We don't have two different crimes. We have one crime. We don't have cumulative punishments. We have one punishment. This is just a question of what does the Persistent Offender Accountability Act mean? And, of course, whenever you look at the Persistent Offender Act, well, first of all, an underlying crime has been committed. And secondly, you have to look at multiple provisions of the SRA to decide what sentence is authorized. I don't believe there is any case where you could just look at one particular statutory provision and say, this provision tells you the penalty for this crime. The SRA is a fairly complicated document with a number of different provisions which you have to look at together. So the second thing to understand is that this statute is not ambiguous. The prosecuting attorney shall file a special allegation of sexual motivation in any criminal case other than sex offenses as defined in 994A030, where sufficient evidence exists that it was sexually motivated. Every criminal case except a defined sex offense, second-degree assault is not defined as a sex offense, and it is the underlying theory does not make it defined as a sex offense. It only becomes a sex offense when there is an allegation of sexual motivation. The language in this statute is essentially the same as the language in the weapons enhancement statutes. You know, where those statutes say the firearm enhancements in this section apply to all felony crimes except certain listed crimes. And the Supreme Court said in Kelly that means what it says. And if the crime does not appear on that list, you can have a weapons enhancement, and it doesn't matter that the crime may itself have elements of possession or use of a weapon, so long as it doesn't appear on the list. And the third thing to recognize is that the Supreme Court has already answered the specific question in this case. Can you apply a sexual motivation enhancement to a crime that includes an element of a sex crime if that crime is not defined as a sex crime? And not to make this overly complicated, the crime involved there was felony murder with intent to commit rape, State v. Thomas. So, you know, say you could, and appellant did raise this very same argument here. Murder with intent to commit rape is inherently a sexual crime, therefore you can't stick a sexual motivation enhancement on top of it. And the Supreme Court said that's not the correct analysis. You don't look at the specific charging theory. You look at the generic crime. Felony murder generically is not a sex offense. The legislature intended it to be punished more severely when it is committed for a sexual purpose, such as the purpose of rape. So the same analysis applies here. The level of analysis is second-degree assault a sex offense? The answer is no. The legislature intended, so if you do have a circumstance where it was committed for a sexual purpose, the legislature intended to have it treated as a sex offense. What we have as a rule here is simply that sex offenses committed for a sexual purpose, are treated differently than other offenses, and we don't stick the sex offense label on top of something that's already defined as a sex offense because it's pointless. You know, they're already defined as that. The enhancement doesn't tell you anything, doesn't label it, doesn't select it out for special treatment. You know, there are numerous statutory provisions which provide special treatment for sex offenses because the legislature has recognized that they are different and need to be treated differently. Yet somehow it's suggested to you that if the crime is second-degree assault and it's committed with sexual motivation and it's a sex offense, yet that should be excluded from all those provisions and you should treat it just the same as any other second-degree assault. Well, that's not what the legislature said. That's not what the Supreme Court said in Thomas. The sexual motivation label was properly charged, properly proved, and in accordance with the Persistent Offender Act, this defendant was properly sentenced as a persistent offender. The judgment and sentence should be affirmed.
Before you leave, the abiding belief language is in a bracket. What's the intent of that?
The intent is it is optional with trial judges. It can be used by trial judges if they see fit or can be omitted by trial judges if they see fit. And, you know, if you look statewide, some do one, some like it, some don't like it. You know, I think that, looking statewide, some prosecutors like it, some don't like it. Some defense attorneys like it, some don't like it. I've seen closing arguments where that language has been effectively used by both sides to support their theory. This is not inherently slanted language. It's language that's been used in the state of Washington for a long time. It was language found in the classic Tanzimore instruction, which was later revised. And there's nothing wrong with it. It should remain available for trial judges to give it to when they see fit to do so.
So, Judge Tricky, just to confirm, our challenge on that abiding belief instruction, it's referred to as that, but our argument is with the truth language. I certainly agree that a jury's belief in guilt should be an abiding and enduring one. Mr. Fine says that this is not a double jeopardy case because it's a crime and enhancement imposed in the same proceeding. The same could be said of the Kelly firearm enhancement case, but the Supreme Court went through the double jeopardy analysis there and asked, is there clear legislative intent to apply a firearm enhancement to second-degree assault with a firearm? They found that there was, and that double jeopardy argument did not prevail. The Thomas case involved rape. It was not a it was a statutory construction case, not a double jeopardy case. If it had been a double jeopardy case, the person arguing that there was a double jeopardy violation would have lost in a way that shows why we should prevail, because that case involved intent to rape, but I believe felony murder based on rape. There would be no problem adding a sexual motivation enhancement to felony murder with intent to rape or assault with intent to rape, because rape does not involve a purpose of sexual gratification. It's only a physical act. Here, what you have is complete duplicativeness between the mental state stated as an element of the underlying crime and the mental state for which a person receives an enhancement. So I'm asking the court to look not at the statutory language alone and stop there. If the court did that in double jeopardy cases, we would never have those signal cases such as robbery and assault, where we say that a punch on somebody's shoulder to steal their wallet violates double jeopardy. On the face of the statutes, it absolutely does not, but because of the facts, it does.
Thank you, counsel.